Welcome, 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 everybody, to the Hockey Think Tank podcast brought to you by thehockeythinktank.com. My name is Topher Scott, and we have an awesome episode here today. Pretty special one for me. We have the guy that gave me my start in college hockey, both as a player and as a real assistant coach, Mike Schaefer, who's been the head coach at Cornell since 1995. He's one of the most decorated coaches in college hockey today, over 400 career wins, a four-time ECAC Coach of the Year. He's brought Cornell to a Frozen Four, consistently one of the top teams in the country, and it was really cool to be able to talk to him a couple years removed from being on his staff, just about some of the philosophies that he's had, and obviously being there and knowing him as well as I do, I kind of knew all the things that he thought, but I thought it would be awesome for everybody else to kind of hear what his philosophies are on kids and on coaching and teaching and stuff like that as well. So, but before we get to Coach Schaefer, let's bring in my partner on the podcast, Jeff Lavecchio. How's it going in St. Louis today?
It's great, Toph. I just buried a carton of eggs. I got my protein intake, and I'm ready to go.
Okay. How many eggs do you eat a day, like legitimately?
Six.
Six?
Six eggs at a time. Seriously, six eggs.
That's insane. Well, cool. Well, I obviously know Schaefer really well, having played for him and coached with him. But you knew you got to know him a little bit through my wedding and things like that. But what were your thoughts on just some of the stuff that he talked about in our conversation today?
I really like him. You know, obviously, I knew him at least, you know, from conversations we had at your wedding when I was in your wedding. You know, bagged on him a little bit for not recruiting me to Cornell so I could have played with you. You know, we had a good time with that. And if you listen all the way to the end, you'll hear about what happened at Tope's wedding between me and the Cornell coaching staff and their wives. No spoiler alert here, but yeah, teaser. But I like, you know, he's a stand-up guy. Like, he's, I don't want to say he's like super old school. Like, it seems like he's able to understand today's youth with everything they have going on their lives and phones and technology, but he also brings in that kind of old school aspect of character, respect, morality, all of that. Just seems like a great guy and a coach that I would have liked to have played for.
Yeah, no, he's one of those guys, what you see is what you're going to get, and you know exactly where you stand at all times.
Which was he a mind games guy or no? Doesn't seem like it.
No. Again, it's what you see is what you get. You're going to know exactly where you stand for the good and the bad. And I think for anybody that's, you know, playing at a high level, that's what you want. You need to know when and how to get better. You need to know also some of the things that you're doing well. And again, he talked a lot about relationships. He talked a lot about communication and how important that is, you know, not even necessarily from coach to player, but also player to player too. And, you know, playing at Cornell, that's one thing that I'll always take with me is the camaraderie and the culture that we had. And just, you know, we even had five guys that were back into town a couple weeks ago. And that was, you know, the best time I've had in a while, just being able to reconnect with those guys. And I think it's really special. I think you get that at a lot of different places in terms of college, because you get to know people really well. You're there for 4 years together through the ups and the downs and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, I've talked to other people and I know about some other places. And I think that Cornell is really special when it comes to those kinds of things. So it was cool. I know a lot of the things that he does, and a lot of things that we did as a coaching staff to try and foster that kind of culture and camaraderie, but it was cool to hear him, and I think a lot of people really enjoy hearing about how he built the program based on the relationship model and how important it is to the success that Cornell has had for, you know, the past couple decades that he's been there.
For sure. And you know, do you ever see the Nard dog when you go back there? You ever see
Andy Bernard? Andy Bernard, the Nard dog. He gave the convocation speech a couple of years ago. So he came back and for everybody that was graduating, he spoke, and he spoke a little bit as Andy Bernard.
Yeah, did he play the banjo?
I don't think he played the banjo, no, but I remember watching it. I wasn't there, but I remember watching it on YouTube, and The Office is my favorite show. So I actually just watched that episode where Dwight became an applicant to go to Cornell,
and he's interviewing him.
Yeah, and Andy's interviewing him. So I thought that was awesome. But it is funny, like the Cornell thing on the recruiting path. Like The Office is obviously a huge show, and so many people like it. But like I've had kids, as you're walking them around campus or you're talking to them on the phone, they'd be like, Andy Bernard went to Cornell. That's Did he actually great. Go to Cornell and all this kind of stuff? And that's I'm like, dude, yes, I'll commit you right now because The Office is your favorite show.
Yeah. Oh, roasted. You're in.
Yeah, exactly. But it's really cool. I think coaches and parents and players will get a lot out of, what Schaaf is talking about. And again, he says it like it is. You know, he's not afraid of ruffling a few feathers, and he's not afraid to be honest, and I think that's something that is really important, especially in the college hockey game today. So it was really fun to hear him talk, and I think we've talked enough, so let's move it on to Coach Schaefer. So this is a really special episode that we have here today. We have Mike Schaefer, the head coach of Cornell Big Red Hockey. He's the guy that I played for when I was at Cornell and the guy that I coached with in my 5 years coaching at Cornell. So Coach Schaefer, how are we doing today?
Doing great. Guys, how are you guys doing?
Doing well.
Doing well.
Doing well. First snow up here in upstate New York, so got a couple more layers on in the house, that's for sure.
Yes, from Marquette, Michigan back to Ithaca, all kinds of snow.
Oh yeah, was it snowing out in Michigan as well?
Yeah, we got a bit 5 or 6 inches when we were up there, so it was good to definitely signify us hockey season's here to stay for the rest of the year.
Yeah, love it. Well, getting right to it, I wanted to ask you, and I think your story is really, really cool based on, you know, where you grew up and the family that you had. Obviously not a lot of people know, but you grew up in Durham, Ontario, and you were the youngest of 9 kids. Talk to us a little bit about growing up in Durham and what it was like with such a big family.
Well, I mean, obviously, you know, relating to coaching wise, I mean, it's, small town. Obviously character is everything. With regards to everybody knows what you're doing, where you're from, who you're related to. So, everything you do in Faye is, means a big deal. And came from, relatively no means, but didn't really know anything that we didn't come from any financial, background or means economically, and family of 9, it was really 2 families, a family of five and family of 4, in real small town, small house, and hockey was at the center, and sports was the center of everything, with regards to hockey in the wintertime and softball in the summertime. So it was looking back at it, was it's something that a great way to grow up, a great community to grow up in, and as far as family is concerned, I said all the values, and looking back at now from a coaching perspective, everything that is probably at the base for me as a coach was garnered from being a family of 9 and being in a small town in a real blue collar town. So that was probably the breeding ground for all the things that I believe in were right there in family and hometown.
That's awesome. And, I would probably call you, I would call you the most competitive person I've ever met in my entire life. Do you think being the youngest of 9, did that kind of foster your competitiveness and just earning kind of what you get in where you grew up?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think that, growing up with 5 other brothers, I mean, every day was a competition. Doing paper out, going from always having to compete against older kids. In hockey, I would play a ball hockey game to carry my skates in my paper bag and play a nice hockey game, and something that should have taken me a half hour took me 3 hours to get home. So everything was my brothers were very, very competitive. So it was just, not knowing, but it was just a natural way to grow up. Everything was sports and everything was a competition. And, in town, the same thing, it's kind of weird to talk about it, but you fought a lot when you were growing up because, that's how you settle things. and in my hometown especially, that's how you settle things. And it was either you competed and you you pushed through or you got pushed around. So it was everything that you would naturally think of growing up. That's where the basis of everything that basically, you know, becomes who you are. It's a weird thing, but you know, I just think that, as I said, growing up with brothers and not many of them, that was just innately in me. And I have three really, really probably competitive brothers and three guys that are probably really kind of more laid back. So it's interesting how it's kind of worked out.
Yeah.
Let's take it back to the skates and a paper bag thing. Why a paper bag?
Well, paper. I delivered a paper route. So I had it's a big canvas bag where you had all your newspapers in. So you just carried your skates along with you. You jumped into games when you had the opportunity that you knew that you were going by this high school or a school, and that's they had flooded ice. So you always knew there was a game there.
Gotcha.
That's awesome. And so you parlayed. You know, you grew up rural Durham, Ontario. Small town and played junior hockey up in Ontario as well. And then you found your way to play at Cornell, one of the most decorated players in Cornell history. You know, what was it like getting to Cornell and coming to an Ivy League school based on, you know, where you came from? Was that something that your family was really proud of you? I know that's something that you worked really hard for, but describe to us your time at Cornell and how proud you were to get there from where you grew up.
Well, I mean, I think the pride-wise was probably more afterwards than before or during. I mean, none of my family members, except for my brother, went to Northern Michigan, really went to a college, and my parents didn't go to any kind of, you know, even high school. So it was, my parents were very proud of me for, I think, getting, you know, playing junior hockey and getting to a university. I don't think they understood the quality of school that I was going to, as far as an Ivy League school. I mean, that just didn't really kind of register with them, but they were, you know, extremely proud that, you know, I said, like, I was able to, you know, get out of Durham in the sense of getting to a university and just going to university in general, not even an Ivy League school. So, you know, obviously, you know, later, you know, obviously I understood the ramifications of being an Ivy League school, but just the fact that I got to school and got to a university, there was a great deal of pride. And then now looking back at it, you're just, really, really fortunate. Lucky as a lot of junior players that go on and leave home. I was just fortunate enough that things worked out well for me. And that junior, you know, when you're living away from home, there's a lot of distractions that occur. And I've always looked back and just realized I was really, really lucky. You know, really grateful that someone saw something in me, and now I'm on the other side of the recruiting aspect of it, I realize even more how lucky I was that someone took a chance on me, and I've always been very, very grateful to Lou Raycroft for that.
Yeah, Lou's the man. Well, that's great. And you know, you finished playing at Cornell and got right into coaching at Cornell. So, you know, you coached even guys that you played with. You know, what was that transition into coaching like? And I know it wasn't really on your radar to start once you were done, but how'd you get into coaching?
Well, it was all Lou. I mean, I think that started off with making money in hockey schools again, Don McKee, my old junior coach, gave me a lot of responsibility at hockey schools as far as running my own group and as a young guy, you know, was going to college and kind of took that, enjoyed that aspect of that responsibility. And then just, knew the hockey career was not going anywhere when I got out and Lou Raycroft saw something in me as far as, gave me an opportunity and hired me for big whopping $14,000, coach JV, coach phys ed classes, was assistant coach and much different, you know, back then. But, he just saw something in me that allowed me to stay embark in the coaching to see what it was like. So it was the first time Cornell had a second assistant, and you know, I said it was, he gave me my opportunity by, you know, giving that job, when I was graduating. It was weird. It was weird, definitely weird to, you know, be involved with, you know, guys that you played with. And you know, as a young coach, that was the first example of, you know, knowing what it was, but separating quickly that, you know, I was on the different side of it. You know, those guys that those first couple of years handled it really, really well, that there was separation between coach and player and friend, and it worked out well.
Yeah, that's awesome. Well, your coaching career since then has certainly worked out well as well. And want to bring you back to the beginning when you became a head coach at Cornell in 1995. Obviously, you're still the head coach there now, but I thought it was really interesting just in doing a little bit more research today. You know, you became the head coach in 1995, and Cornell was kind of struggling at the time, and you came in, and in your first two seasons as the head coach, you won ECAC championships. How'd you do it? I mean, I think that's pretty amazing that you come in first and second year winning championships. You know, what was that like, and how did you turn that program around?
Well, I mean, good players. I mean, when I got here, I was, you know, I was really, I was lucky to be, you know, when I got the job, and I don't think that happens very often. And, I was just lucky. I mean, in the sense that, you know, you look back at, I mean, that was some of the deepest teams I've ever had a chance to coach. And that group of guys were a great group of fours and a great defense core and a goaltender that actually a couple goaltenders and, you know, actually three goaltenders and Jean-Marc Belcher, Jason Elliott, and Eddie Skazik. And, you know, I just think it's just, you know, for whatever reason, just a change of scenery for the players. You know, that with the, you know, from the previous Brian, McCutcheon was a great coach. And, you know, even myself, you know, there's been different periods of opportunity times where I've had great teams, but, things just aren't going well. And so I was lucky to get the job just in the right place at the right time, being a Cornell alum and at the right age. And it was just, those guys were, you know, obviously were very eager and you know, they had lost a lot the year before. So they were eager to, you know, change their own way as a big senior class. I mean, there was so it was just the right timing. And I think you saw after that, it was, you know, we kind of dropped off a little bit for a couple of years, and that was, you know, because we had to replace a lot of guys that were really, really good players.
Yeah. Cool. And, you know, just talking about, the players and talking about your journey through coaching at Cornell. You know, Cornell is obviously a school that everybody knows and everybody refers to as just A+ when it comes to being defensive, playing well defensively, preaching the defensive side of the game. You know, is that something that you take a lot of pride in, but also is that something, and we've had a lot of conversations about this, that maybe is a little bit of a misconception in terms of, you know, it's all about defense. Talk to us a little bit about your philosophy when it comes to preaching defense, but also, you know, as a whole, how it relates to how you want your team to play.
Well, I mean, I think that, anybody in coaching knows you can't win without being a good defensive team. And it doesn't matter what sport you're in. And if you can't get the ball in soccer or basketball and you can't get stops and you can't, you know, control other teams defensively in the NFL or college football, or whatever, I mean, you're just not going to win. And, you know, I think that, you know, it's always been the basic fundamental that, you know, on the defensive side really shows character. I mean, that's where, you know, I think that any person, any, you know, one can do the job defensively if they have character. And so it's always been the building block for, you know, for our teams, and that we want kids that want to be committed to knowing that there are different nights that you can win a game 2-1 or 1-0. And then our best teams are guys that have the offensive ability, that they combine that character with that they'll play for each other, they'll play hard for each other. But at the same time, when we, you know, guys mature as players on the team, or we have fortune enough that different years kids blossom in and their offensive abilities allow us, you know, then you have great teams. And so, you know, you're the years that you were here and even before you, when when we have that combination of kids that want to play for each other and play hard on both sides of the puck, but at the same time have the offensive abilities, it turns into something special. But at the same time, when guys don't make that transition to college hockey, that their offensive skills don't translate, we can still win. And I think that has been the key to our being the continuity of our program, that even in the down years or when recruiting doesn't work out, which it does, you know, it happens, we're still able to win hockey games. And the misconception is that we're always just about defense. That's not true, but that's okay. I'm something that I'm comfortable with, that people think that, but you know, it's something within our program that people have played here know that's not the truth.
Is there something that you do specifically that kind of gets the players to buy in? Because, you know, especially today's day and age with internet and social media, everyone, you know, I'm not going on NHL.com and seeing a defenseman block a shot, really, or go down on a 2-on-1 and make a great play. All you're seeing is the goals. So is there something specifically you do from a coaching standpoint to get your team to buy in to really focusing on the defensive part of the game?
Well, I go back to it. It's not the defensive part of the game. It's the game. You know, I think it starts with recruiting. You know, you got to recruit the right kind of kids that, you know, we're not reinventing the game in the sense of the way hockey is played. It's a game of transition back and forth from offense to defense all night long. And you know, the kids that have great hockey sense understand that. And the guys that have not great character, that don't want to play defense or don't want to do those things, that starts in recruiting. And that's where, you know, you have to have great assistant coaches that see a great offensive player, but they're just not committed to the team. And in the sense of they pout when they don't have the puck, or they can't get the puck, or they pout when, you know, a coach maybe jumps on them because, you know, they're asking them to do the unthinkables, back check or, you know, compete for pucks, right?
I mean, how dare you?
Yeah, it's you know, and it's littered through U16 and U14 hockey, where, you know, you watch it, where, you know, parents are, you know, when kids are held accountable for the simplest of things, you know, if, you know, parents, you know, lose their mind, you know, that, you know, of cutting their shift short or playing for the good of the team. And it's you know, and I watch it. I mean, so you ask where it is. It's not about teaching them that. It's about holding them accountable for that. And that starts in recruiting process. And I've had great assistant coaches that, you know, everybody looks at the 5-star recruit. It's not the 5-star recruit. It's the guy that, you know, was willing to play both ways. And we've been fortunate. As I said that our guys understand that playing for me, it's not magic. I mean, it's just, that's the way the game is played. And some guys can handle that and some guys can't. That's all right. I mean, you know, there's a lot of good players out there. And it's just part of our culture is that we hopefully play the game the right way, and we play for each other. And that's fun. No one wants to be involved with a team where, you know, you have 3 or 4 or 5 guys that don't want to play that way. That's not fun. That wears on athletes throughout the course of the year.
So to kind of piggyback off something you just brought up in recruiting, and, you know, you talked about pouting and body language. We had a really good call with Coach George Gwozdecki, and we went in depth with him about what he was looking for in the recruiting process. And one of the biggest things he said was, you know, body language, and what are they doing when they come back from a shift? Are they looking at a coach? I know personally, just all the kids that I train here in St. Louis that are on my AAA teams that I work with, you know, they listen to this, and I'm constantly harping on them about, you know, be a good teammate, have good body language. Like, it's the little things that will add up to big things. It's not just, did you score a goal tonight? So what kind of things do you look for or tell your assistants to look for in that recruiting process? Like, obviously points, goals, assists, we know those things, but past that, are there certain things you're looking for while you're out there on the road recruiting?
Well, I think Tope knows this. I mean, I think the first thing as a recruiter, you got to know how the team's supposed to play, right? I mean, you know, you go into a game, or the defenseman is supposed to pinch, you know, are you supposed to block shots? I mean, that's part of what the coach, you know, wants. Are they, you know, a discipline 1-2-2, you know, where you're, you know, and so knowing what the team is actually supposed to do, you know, is the first thing in recruiting, because, you know, how can you tell whether the kid is kind of following a game plan if you don't know what the game plan kind of is before even you go to the rink as a recruiter, as a coach? Wow. You know, and, you know, hockey sense is, you know, obviously, you know, with that, right? So if kids are supposed to jump up in the play, but they don't, you know, or if kids are supposed to, you know, on the penalty kill, what exactly are they supposed to be doing? And even at a young age. And so you're trying to watch what, you know, as you go into the game, what, you know, the present coach is already teaching. Are they supposed to slide on a 2-on-1, or are they supposed to stay on their feet? So if they're supposed to stay on their feet and they're sliding, it's not a great thing. So it's just hockey sense. You know, I think that, you know, George is right. I mean, George is old school. You're watching guys, and that's why when you're watching on fast hockey, you can't see how kids are reacting. You know, you don't see whether the kid's back checking. You don't see whether the kid's, you know, paying the price on a puck coming out of the zone. Is it a habit? Are they doing it all the time, regardless of who they play? The best team, the worst team, you know, the team that they should beat, are they doing those same things? So we're with George. I mean, which a great example is watching U14 hockey, just because it was in our rink with Mike Richter, and, you know, and watching him coach his team. And, you know, those kids don't even know who he is anymore, probably. You know, they understand, but they don't know how great of a player he is, but even more important, how great of a person he is. And, you know, it's just so watch kids handle his coaching and watch them, you know, watch how kids interact with their parents. You know, it's, I go back to what I talked about at the start of the podcast. I mean, I would never say anything to my parents ever, you know, like it would be the unthinkable. And so just watching kids interact with their parents and how they deal with their siblings, and it tells you a lot about a kid. And, you know, as you get older and they get to college, there's a lot of distractions. And so, you know, when kids are going to do that in front of their parents, or they're going to do that in a U16 game, it's going to rear its head ugly. If it's a proper English, but it's going to rear its head when things happen in college. When all those distractions occur. So that's why assistant coaches in recruiting is they're the ones that find that out. And that's the important aspect of it. So, and how can you tell that you guys are at U14, U16? That's just part of life. Kids grow up and they make mistakes and they learn from. And so recruiting at the U16 and U14 level is really difficult, unless you really, really know that where the kids comes from, the salt of the earth with parents, and that's going to change.
Yeah. What about when you're recruiting a U8-year-old?
Yeah. It's a lot of kids have really developed that character when they're 8 years old.
Well, it's always interesting, because I've been in those recruiting rooms with you, and, you know, a couple things come to mind, and we would always talk about, especially when kids would come to visit, how they interacted with their family and what their mom and dad were like. And, you know, it works both ways. I remember, you know, I sent a tweet out there a couple weeks ago about my first recruiting visit that as an assistant coach, and you were basically in there for about 5 minutes and left me out to frickin' dry because the dad was a ding dong, and you were like, there's no way we're recruiting this kid. I got better things to do. And I was like, oh, okay. But then you look at other kids, you know, you look at a Charlie McAvoy who we had on campus, and obviously he's gone on to do really good things, and he was a young kid at the time, and we liked him as a player, but then we kind of fell in love with him on the visit, him and his dad, and they were talking about all the volunteer work that they were doing with Hurricane Sandy, and we were like, man, we got to have this kid. It's just too good of a family to pass up. Like, talk a little bit about, because I think it's something that people need to hear, especially parents need to hear. Like, they do have an effect on their kids' recruiting process, whether it's in a visit, whether it's the way they, you know, act at a certain game that coaches are watching. If you have any advice for parents, I think that would be great.
Yeah, everybody has lots of advice for parents, but they never listen.
Yeah, it's true.
I think parents are and families are what they are, and I think that it's a rare that a parent that can change by listening to a podcast or reading a book. They just won't change, and you know, and but you're right. We, you know, you watch parents, and who wants to bring that into your culture? Because parents, even at the college level, they'll sit and talk with each other, and we ask our kids all the time what is one of the biggest distractions they have, and they'll talk about their parents. And, you know, it's been really interesting for me, even since Tolf, you've left, we've had some kids that kids have sat down and we've really got into them, and we've like, they've had some zero tolerance with their parents. They don't want to talk about hockey with their parents anymore. And it's been one of the biggest factors of kids growing and developing as kids at our level, because finally they've got away from that judgment from their parents. They're no longer being judged, and now they can self-evaluate. And the parents have a huge impact. You know, they will have an impact right up until they're at college. But you're right, the parents, that when the kid's doing the talking on the visit, you know that you've got something good. You know, if it's the parent where the kid won't, you know, doesn't say a word, it's not a good thing. And you know, you can see it at the games where, you know, parents are, are into their kids after the game, and other parents who, you know, like my dad, I go back to my own dad. My dad would stand at the end of the rink all by himself, wouldn't talk to anybody, would pick me up out in the parking lot after I carried her, make me walk home, and you know, and just never talked about hockey, ever. You know, never gave me advice, never. He just told me, hey, the coach is not playing, you play better. You know, pretty simple stuff, you know.
Go ahead.
You know, most people are competitive. They're, you know, kids, you know, they just, if you're not playing it, there's a reason for it. But everybody doesn't want to hear the reason. So it is. The parents have a huge impact. And I think most parents know that they need to be quiet, or they know they need to step back. But it's hard, you know, because parents are very, very involved, in which they have to be. You know, they're driving them everywhere. And but it's not the fact that parents don't know they shouldn't. It's just they can't help themselves. And that's it said at the lesson, even at our level, where I said kids are now saying to their parents, hey, we don't want to even talk about hockey. It's affecting who I am. And that's good.
Yeah, for sure. Well, you talk about kind of the parent and the kid relationship, and you know, I would imagine, and we've had a lot of talks about this. I mean, things are a lot different now in 2018 than they were when you took over in 1995, and there's certain things that you can do and certain things that you can't do, just based on, you know, everybody always likes to talk about millennials and the kids of today. How have you seen dealing with players change? How have you changed, and what are some things that maybe you don't want to change in terms of, you know, dealing with kids and being a coach today as opposed to where you were when you started?
Well, I mean, obviously a lot of things have changed, but everything's based on relationships. I mean, you know, to go on the road and, you know, to see guys, no phones that allowed, you know, on the road at tables. And given that, you know, just this past weekend at Northern Michigan is a prime example. Kids really haven't changed as long as you give them opportunity to be who they are. And you know, to sit at a table on the road and watch guys talk and watch hang out with each other and talk about things and have conversations. And so, yeah, they have changed because of technology. But we've kind of rolled with it. You know, we now communicate and set things up through their phones and where they, you know, get their meetings and the calendar and everything else. But the basic premise of the relationships with each other and, what is the best experience of everybody going to college? It's your friendships. And so we still, we still harp on it. Push it. We'll hold guys accountable, and at the same time, you know, I think that, you know, trying to reach out to some of these guys and reach them and show them the analytics and show them you know articles and get them involved and listening and seeing things is one thing, but the flat out bare bones, you know, building blocks is relationships and teammate to teammate and coach to teammate and coach the team. That's where it is. It always has been and always will be. And that's something that, you know, again, I probably, how have I changed? I've started off with that and I got distracted a little bit about maybe giving some too much ownership to our team and reading too many books and doing different things. And now I've gone back to over the last 3 or 4 years, you know what, you know, just enjoy it. Come to the rink and, you know, there's an old saying with our guys is just be quiet, you know, shut up, you know, don't worry about what we're teaching and just do what we're asking you to do and just enjoy each other. And, you know, I think that that's where I've gone full circles. I'm back to now, like, this is what we're going to do, and this is how we're going to do it. You guys just come to the rink and enjoy it, and stop thinking so much and just have fun.
So I have a question about something you just said, because this is my first year, you know, being retired from playing, and I'm an assistant coach for a midget major U18 team, and you were talking about the cell phone thing. Do you have any, like, specific rules? Like, I'm guessing it's, you know, no phones in the room, you know, unless you're playing music on it. But, you know, our head coach will collect cell phones on the bus. And, you know, when we stay in hotels on the road, they collect them at night. Like, do you have rules about that? And how do you feel about that? Because, like you said, like, you know, we'll be on the bus or we're in a room or something, and I got 20 guys, 18 of them are buried in their phone, not talking to each other. So do you think it's, you know, something that you just say to them and it's, you know, get off your phone, or do you take them, or how do you approach that situation?
I did take them at one point in time when I didn't think they were focused, and they weren't self-evaluating. They were self-absorbed with their phones. I have done that in the past where I've collected them, but, you know, I go back to the team meals in our locker room, and when we travel on the road, where we're in the locker room, we're at meals, there's just no phones allowed. And, you know, so they talk, but I can't, you know, they go back to, you can't control their every moment of every day of their lives. And they got to learn how to, you know, to balance that. So I go back to the relationships. It's, you know, the kids are pretty committed nowadays. They work hard, they eat right, they sleep right, they do all these things. And, you know, the phone is just a different distraction that, you know, now that we're just trying to teach guys that they got to deal with. And it's about video games, and give you a class example of someone who on our team wanted to be a leader. And, you know, he was a leader his freshman year. And then all of a sudden, you know, he wasn't, you know, kind of on the leadership council, and guys are like we're out of touch with him. He doesn't know who we are. He doesn't, you know, he doesn't spend any time with us. He doesn't, you know, because he's playing video games all the time. And, you know, that is, when we evaluated it, when his relationship, he didn't want that. He wanted to be a leader, and he wanted to be recognized. And we talked about, again, it's relationships. And if you're not involved in the relationships, you can't be a leader. And so that was a good, you know, it's just an example of, you know, that in managing the technology of what guys do, and understand that it's not okay to spend all your time hanging out on and playing Fortnite or playing this game or playing another game because you don't have the respect of your teammates. And so it's just managing it and understanding, again, the basis of it is relationships. It's no different than 30 years ago. If a guy's been all his time with his girlfriend, you know, he doesn't know what's going on in the team. So it's just a different distraction.
Yeah, for sure. And yeah, it was interesting because when we were coaching together, and I still remember this, I'll always remember, we went over to Europe and did a little European trip. And, you know, being over in Europe, guys didn't have cell phone service because we were in a different continent. And remember going, you know, driving through Switzerland and driving through Italy, and almost kind of looking back, and everybody was laughing and they were playing board games and everybody was loud and all that kind of stuff. And we're like, holy crap. Oh yeah, they don't have phones anymore. So that is something that'll always stick with me. And you know, that's one of the things that I always appreciated about coaching with you and coaching at Cornell and playing at Cornell, is I always felt like, you know, the culture was something that was really strong, and those relationships that you talk about are really, really important. And you know, I was in three of my teammates' weddings. I had three guys in my wedding, and you know, now that we're all having kids, you know, we still keep in touch and stuff like that. How do you develop that kind of camaraderie as a coach? Is that something that you put, I kind of have been in those conversations, so I kind of know, but I think it would be cool to explain to people who are listening, just how do you feel, what are some certain things that you might do to be able to better create those relationships within the team that are so important to your culture and to winning in college hockey?
Well, I mean, I think it starts day one. I mean, you've been here, so you know that, you know, you got to, everybody, when they walk on campus, what do you want? I mean, you look back at all your experiences as a player, doesn't matter what team that you're on, what are all the things that bothered you when you were a player? And I remember walking on campus at Cornell, remembering, you know, I'm going into my dorm, and I haven't seen any teammates yet. And, you know, the last few years we've had every one of our guys is there welcoming our guys to campus. And how is that initial first impression saying, hey, these guys are really important. You know, they you know, and they're good teammates. They're over here helping me. And so I go back to it about developing all those relationships, about having team building. Like, you know, everybody talks about team building, but team building is more than doing an exercise. It's about knowing about, again, about your, you know, your teammates, knowing what their families, knowing about what makes them tick, what makes them, you know, what's their, you know, you've been involved in those exercises about the hardest times of their life and their best times of their life, and know, just knowing a person. And, you know, and I think a lot of times that, yeah, we gather, we were around our teammates a lot, but everybody's around their team a lot, but you know, what do you really know about your team and how much can you depend on it? So, you know, and then I think that, you know, so that the exercise and team building are one thing, but it's about, you know, for, I think for a lot of athletes are reviewing that. And, you know, all of us, all what do we want to be? We want to be accepted and we want respect. And that's the two basic premises of, you know, I think what everybody kind of fights for their whole life is that they want to be respected by other people, you know, and they want to be accepted by other people. And, you know, I think that when you go back and having an exercise at the end of the season or midseason and finding out, you know, what our teammates think of us, you know, and or what our peers think of us and why they might not respect us and why they might not accept us. You know, I think those are breeding grounds for great change. And, you know, so it's constantly, it's constant paying attention to get back to the relationships of, you know, with the players, with each other, and putting them in positions where they, you know, they communicate with each other and find out about each other and grow with each other. And that's what university is all about, you know, so it's more than just hockey. And some of the best team building activities we've had is we've, you know, gone to the Dominican and the same thing, no cell phones in an area where you're talking with the kids for, you know, from 6 a.m. till when they go to bed at night. It's something that you work at, but, you know, the exercises are one thing, but it's that, you know, of the exercises where they actually get to know each other are the most important things.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, you talk about, just for the listeners, the Dominican trip. So every couple of years, Coach Schaefer takes some community members and some of the guys from the team on a service trip, a mission trip down the Dominican Republic to a pretty impoverished area. And they've helped build wings of schools and churches and built latrines and things like that. It's a pretty, a pretty eye-opening experiences for a lot of the players and puts a lot of things into perspective. But also you've talked about how, you know, some of the biggest benefits of those trips are, you know, just getting to know the players on a deeper level away from the rink and away from school and in the summer and less pressured situations. And, you know, another example is I remember you talked about a little bit about it, but my first day on campus as a freshman coming to Cornell, you know, I had five guys that were right there at my dorm and I didn't carry a box into my room. I didn't unpack. I didn't do anything. The players all did it for me. And I remember looking at my parents like, holy shit, like this is unreal. So,
Can you say that on a podcast?
I just did, so I guess so. You know, we did have somebody from Barstool Sports on here before, so we've had a couple of swear words.
Oh, we're good then.
Yeah, yeah.
Shrempy dropped a lot of F-bombs.
Yeah, we had Robbie Shrimp, so you know Robbie Shrimp a little bit. We had him on here, and he there were a lot of bleeps if this weren't a you know, one of those kinds of episodes. But, you know, the last thing I wanted to ask you, and I know you probably got a basketball game coming up here pretty soon, but, you know, you've been very outspoken on recruiting. And we've had a couple conversations with people like Mike Snee with College Hockey Inc. just about, you know, the craziness of the recruiting process right now. And, you know, I've always appreciated your candor when it came to that. I think a lot of people, when they talk about recruiting in the state that it's in right now, they talk out of both sides of their mouth because they'll say one thing but do another. I wanted to, you know, share a list with you, and not just with you, but with the listeners, of just how backwards it can be right now. And I'm looking at, I went on Chris Heisenberg's page this morning and just looking at how many kids are recruited to certain schools. And, you know, you have schools like Michigan has 32 kids recruited right now. Wisconsin has 30. Colorado College has 29. Northeastern has 28. Providence, 26. Notre Dame, Minnesota has 25. You know, that's basically their whole team for the next 4 years, maybe even 5 years. what do you think about the recruiting culture in college hockey? Is it going to change? Can it change? What would you do to make it change? And just talk to us a little bit about your feelings on where it's at right now.
Well, I think that one of the things that I'm going to propose and we're going to talk about hopefully down in Florida this year at the Coast Convention is that I don't want to be – I'll have my own gentleman agreement with schools that you know, that I know that honor them. But in the, now is the time where, you know, I think that no gentleman agreements really kind of exist anymore. And, you know, college coaches, I think that, you know, basically go ahead in the direction of, like, you know, yeah, I see you see a break in a rule, I'm just going to turn you in. And I think we're our sport is going to head towards the sports of where, you know, there's going to be a lot of schools that are going to be under the gun as far as breaking NCAA rules and the recruiting aspect of it. And I think that, I said the gentleman agreement always was growing up, being in this business for a long time, if you see a guy on the road, you just approach them and you talk to them and say, hey, you know that this is not what we do. And guys would have, they would go to your rate, you know. And then we had gentlemen's agreements for a while where guys laid off of it, and there's a few schools, but now it's the wild, wild west. And from everybody, and kids, agents, advisors, schools, I don't blame. You talk about all those schools that have those committed, whether it's ethical, whether it's moral, whatever it is, but it's within the rules to commit as many kids as you want, and then, you know, change your mind, right? I mean, it's well within the prerogative of those programs, so to do that. But however, you don't have you shouldn't have a verbal agreement in place that, you know, kids want to be protected. And I think that's where college recruiting is going to go, is that you're going to see, I think, hopefully a lot more restrictions where we go back to, we can't talk to kids when they're until they're juniors or seniors, go back to, you know, you talk to a kid in front of other guys instead of guys going up and asking you, hey, that's not what we do. They're just going to report guys to the NCAA. So it's going to get a lot uglier. However, you know, I go back to it is that, you know, for me, I don't begrudge people that do it, you know, in a sense of going out and recruiting, and you know, I just don't agree with it, but that's their prerogative and well within their right. You know, but however, it's the same thing as that. Still want kids that have, you know, everybody's worried about a kid changing their mind. When a kid changes their mind, I've never wanted them anyways, don't want them. So you're still looking for those character kids. So I think there's going to be a lot of change on the landscape. I think there's going to be a lot of change with, hopefully with the NCAA, but I think there's going to be a lot of change here in the next couple of years with college coaches just saying they're fed up with different things, and they're just going to start turning guys in for rule violations and so on and so forth. So it's too bad, you know, but that's the direction I think we're headed in.
Gotcha. And obviously that's pretty crazy. And myself and Jeff, both coaching midget hockey now, you know, we see it at a broader level, and we see how, you know, crazy it kind of makes parents and kids at 15, even 14, 16 years old, just with how young it's gotten and how just the uncertainty with people switching commitments and all that kind of stuff. What kind of advice would you give to parents and kids that want to play Division I college hockey, if you can, you know, give them any advice about just how to go and navigate through the process? What would be some of the things that you would say to them?
Well, I just think that treat it like they would treat it when they're picking a college if their kid didn't play hockey. You know, like most people don't start looking at colleges until they're going into their senior year, where they start to what is what they really want. You know, it's more than just about hockey. It's about choosing a school. I think that's one. I think two is that if you're good enough and you're as a player, you're going to get an opportunity. It's really, really evident by all these kids that are committing when they're 15 and 16 that you get thrown to the curb, you know, because they, you know, schools go out and see other kids that are better when they're 18 and 19. So it's that peer pressure that is making kids commit. And they're committing without even knowing, you know, this, Dope, because we've had this conversation. They don't even know you. They don't even know you as a coach.
Yeah.
And who they're going to play for 4 years. And how can you make a commitment to a school that you've never seen their kids, never seen their coach, don't even know who their coach is? So I think parents, I mean, would you entrust somebody, you know, to, you know, your child to a, to a program if you don't know a ton about them, not their winning percentage, but of what they're like as a person. And but again, I go back to it, parents don't listen, and they're going to do what they're going to do. But I think the parents that stay the course and they just relax, let their kid be a kid, you know, those are the kids that seem to end up being the happiest. And so if they, parents could just let their kids be kids and enjoy U14, U16, just let them develop and play, they'll be a lot happier when they're 18 and 19 for sure.
Yeah, that's awesome. And, you know, the last question I had for you, you know, you came to my wedding, Coach, and Jeff was the best man at my wedding, and gave a pretty good best man speech, had people laughing and stuff. And, you know, in his best man speech, he said that, you know, Cornell didn't recruit him, so he was really pissed off, so he was going to try and, you know, dance with all your wives at the wedding. And,
which I did.
Well, we'll see.
I'm pretty sure my wife rejected him again.
Yes.
That's why she's such a good woman.
Well, it's tough, you know. Jeff had his shirt off about 30 minutes into the reception.
Ceremony.
You know, sweating his, yeah, maybe even the ceremony, yeah, just, you know, sweating buckets and just, it was like people were looking at me like, oh my God, who is this guy? But and not in a bad way, in a good way, but
in a great way. Come on.
But that is pretty good that Cornell got rejected by somebody from the Cornell coaching staff twice. So just thought I'd mention that in the end of the podcast.
I think somebody's wife there. I don't know who it was.
Remember we talked about character first.
Exactly.
I didn't think to get into Cornell anyways. Who am I kidding? No chance.
Actually, you did. You told me what your grades were. You could have gotten in.
Yeah.
Not my test score. Grades were good. My ACT or whatever was not as high as yours, that's for sure.
I know.
No, it's up there.
Well, cool. Well, Shafe, thanks so much for taking the time to sit down and talk with us today. Your perspective on college hockey, and I think your journey is so cool. You've had so much success at this level, and you know, I guess we're probably sitting here with a living legend right now. So wish you the best of luck. Hopefully you haven't watched too many of your games on ESPN Plus this year with the terrible commentating for the TV guys that are doing it. So hopefully you guys are watching your games on mute, so I don't get any crap from you guys later on. But appreciate you sitting down with us, and good luck this weekend, and we'll be talking to you soon.
All right, appreciate it, guys. Take care and all the best.
All right, thanks. Bye.